Welcome to the world today. My name is Frank Weltner. I am the librarian for JewWatch, the largest compendium of information about Jewish organizations and news on the internet today. In addition, I am the librarian and archivist for a new website, www.americanussr.com, which is already the largest compendium of history concerning the negative aspects of the United States of America, which the CIA, FBI, the presidency, the Congress, and all other agencies of the United States want you to know nothing about. Today is February the 7th. You're listening to The World Today, and my name is Frank Weltner. First off today, a new settlement built in the Negev is designed to Judaize the area, to displace the indigenous Bedouin communities, and to make things even more untenable for the people who live there. The first housing projects in the new Negev settlement of Carmet went on sale this week. A representative of the Or movement, which promotes racist settlement construction in the Negev and the Galilee for Jews only, said Carmet is being advertised as a town for affluent immigrants from the English-speaking countries. Of course, by immigrants, they mean Jewish people, not Christian people, not Islamic people, but Jewish people. There are 80 families of British, Americans, and South Africans who are coming, Ronnie Flamer, the movement's co-founder, stated. Israel's District Planning and Building Commission of the Southern Region approved the construction of 739 racist housing units for Comets Phase A back in 2005, but it's taken this long to assemble it. The new settlement has a wide collection of funders and supporters, including the Jewish Agency, the Mitar Local Council, the Jewish National Fund, JNF USA, JNF UK, the Ministry of Construction and Housing, the Israel Land Administration, the Ministry for the Development of the Negev and Galilee, the American Evangelical Group, John Hagee Ministries, the OR Movement, and various private donors. Jewish National Fund Chairman Effie Stensler remarked that his organization maintains that the first priority in Israel is the development of the Negev and Galilee for racist reasons, and that is why we have joined forces in the establishment of Carmet. The goal for the establishment of this community is to bring hundreds of new Jewish immigrant families, along with young native Israelis from central Israel. Of course, what he wishes to do is to push out the Bedouin from their natural habitat. The first 116 racist plots are now on the market, and racist residents are expected to move into the first hateful neighborhood during 2013. The hate settlement is intended to compromise over 2,500 housing units for people of hate in Israel, each on an area of 1.5 acres. Marketing the plots for detached houses in the new community of Carmet is the next step in increasing the supply of land for residential purposes in the sought-after area of the northern Negev. The JNF, whose slogan is "Caretakers of the Land of Israel for Over a Century," has a $600 million campaign to revitalize the Negev desert, acting on the words of Israel's first Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, who said, "The Negev will be the test of the creative ability and pioneering valor of Israel." The group is claiming property rights to El Arakib in order to plant a peace forest. They continue on to say, JNF's major initiative to revitalize Israel's southern region is called Blueprint Negev, a name that describes the far-reaching and visionary racist plan to increase the area's Jewish population and improve living conditions for the Jews and not for the Bedouin. Their plan to improve living conditions for all excludes the area's indigenous Bedouin community. Carmet, for example, is located next to the Kraman Forest in the northern Negev, near the location of the future Israeli Army Intelligence Center base, and is surrounded by Bedouin villages. While the Jewish National Fund acknowledges that there are currently 160,000 Bedouin residing in the Negev, half of those in villages unrecognized by Israel, the group claims on its website that Bedouins' nomadic existence ceased in the 1950s. Another deceptive lie. In November 2005, the Israeli government adopted the Negev 2015 plan, a $3.6 billion 10-year scheme aimed at increasing the Jewish population of the Negev by 200,000 by developing upscale residential neighborhoods, fast transportation networks for commuters, high-tech establishments, and better educational facilities for recognized residents only, of course, which means not for the Bedouins. In recent years, the racist JNF and the hate-filled Israel Land Authority have been working to encourage the remaining nomadic Bedouin communities to settle in cities and stay off the land they want to populate. The encouragement has come in the form of regular demolitions of Bedouin villages, like El Arakib, which has been destroyed 12 times. Bedouin land expropriation must stop. Foreigners purchasing houses in the Negev must realize they are kicking others out of theirs. Israel must recognize that the Bedouin have a right to their traditional way of life, that they have been on the land since before the existence of the State of Israel, and that the psychological tactics of destruction and non-recognition cannot continue. But continue it will. The Israelis don't give one damn about the Bedouin. They don't care about Christians. They don't care about Islamic people. These are a racist breed, a prejudiced breed, a nation filled with hatred against all other peoples of this world. And Israel cares only about its own Jewish people. Everyone else be damned, because in their religious literature, everyone else is nothing but cattle. People to be squashed, to be slaughtered, to be butchered, to be chained to companies and used until their bodies give out. This is the goal of the Israeli government, to take everything within its grasp, and to leave nothing to the people who were there originally. This is a nation filled with hate, and you are privileged to watch it fulfill its hate-filled destiny. In case you've been wondering whether or not Earth is going to go into an ice age, such as in the Day After Tomorrow film, the Gulf Stream, which played so significantly in that scenario, does not appear to be slowing down. U.S. scientists who have used satellites to monitor the telltale changes in the height of the sea have made a report confirming work by other scientists. Using different methodologies, these scientists found dramatic short-term variability but no longer-term trend. A slowdown, dramatized, as I said before, in the movie The Day After Tomorrow, is projected by some models of climate change. The research is published in the journal Geophysical Research Letters. The stream is a key process in the climate of Western Europe, bringing heat northwards from the tropics and keeping countries such as the UK 4 to 6 degrees centigrade warmer than they would otherwise be. It forms part of a larger movement of water, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, which is itself one component of the global thermohaline system of currents. Between 2002 and 2009, the team says, there was no trend discernible, just a lot of variability on short timescales. The satellite record going back to 1993 did suggest a small increase in flow, although the researchers cannot be sure it is significant. The changes we're seeing in overturning strength are probably part of a natural cycle. The slight increase in overturning since 1993 coincides with a decades-long natural pattern of Atlantic heating and cooling. So there you have it. If you've been worried that Jake Gyllenhaal and the Snow Boys will be coming to your village, turning you into an ice age with icicles all over you, well, you can forget that. It's evidently not going to happen, at least not today. But the day after tomorrow might be a different story. Let's get to the story on Egypt. Everyone in America, England, France, is concerned. They're all concerned about Egypt. They wonder what will happen if Egypt becomes radicalized like Iran. They're afraid that the balance of power will be upset. There might be a world war. Of course, it would only be a world war if the Europeans invaded. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any problem, probably. Most of this seems to be, in my mind, psychological. It's this hysterical preoccupation with terrorism and with the inability of Europe to control what other people do, which is really none of our business what other people do. That's the whole problem. We have no business even looking at what's going on in Egypt because it's their country and it's not ours. But that never stopped America before. America's used to lying and showing deceit toward other nations until it can occupy them and build bases there, such as we're doing right now in building a base in Afghanistan, which we may mention later today or maybe tomorrow. But the danger to Egypt's revolution, according to Ali Abu-Mamka in the Electronic Intifada, is that Washington is involved. The revolution's danger comes only from Washington, he says. He writes that the greatest danger to the Egyptian revolution and the prospects for a free and independent Egypt emanates not from the Baltaglia, the mercenaries and thugs the regime sent to beat, stone, stab, shoot, and kill protesters in Cairo, Alexandria, and other cities last week, but from Washington. And that's what I've been telling you all along, is that Washington is behind this. The CIA is behind it. We spend billions of dollars on the people at Langley, and they've been in there motivating these people. Nothing happens in that area without the instigation of the CIA, including the establishment of the Ayatollah Khomeini over Iran. Ever since the Egyptian uprising began on the 25th of January, the United States government and the fascist Washington establishment that rationalizes its policies have been scared to death of losing Egypt, or so they say. What they fear losing is a regime that has consistently ignored the rights and well-being of its people in order to plunder the country and enrich the few who control it. And that has done America's bidding, especially supporting Israel in its oppression and wars against the Palestinians and other Arabs. Now, those of us who live in America or in Israel or even in Egypt know that we live in a very wicked world, a world dominated by fascists from Europe who think that they have the right to own colonies in the Middle East and in Africa and elsewhere. The fascist Obama administration quickly dissociated itself from its envoy to Egypt, Frank Wisner, after the latter candidly told the BBC on the 5th of February that he thought the president of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, must stay in office in order to steer any transition to a post-Mubarak order. But one suspects that Wisner was inadvertently speaking in his master's voice. U.S. President Barack Obama and his fascist security establishment may be willing to give up Mubarak the person, but they're certainly not willing to give up Mubarak's regime. It is notable that the U.S. has never supported the Egyptian protesters' demand that Mubarak must go now, nor has the United States suspended its $1.5 billion annual aid package to Egypt, much of which goes to the state security forces that are pressing protesters and beating up and arresting journalists. As the New York Times, always a reliable barometer of official thinking, reported, the United States and leading European nations on Saturday threw their weight behind Egypt's vice president, Omar Suleiman, backing his attempts to defuse a popular uprising without immediately removing President Hosni Mubarak from power. Obama administration officials, the newspaper added, said Mr. Suleiman had promised them an orderly transition that would include constitutional reform and outreach to opposition groups. Moreover, the Times reported the United States has already managed to persuade two of its major European clients, the United Kingdom and Germany, to back continuing the existing regime with only a change of figurehead. Suleiman, long the powerful chief of Egypt's fascist intelligence services, has served, perhaps even more so than Mubarak, as the guarantor of Egypt's regional role in maintaining the American and Israeli-dominated order. As author Jane Mayer has documented, Suleiman played a key role in the U.S. rendition program, working closely with the CIA, which kidnapped terror suspects from around the world and delivered them into Suleiman's hands for interrogation and, almost certainly, torture. High praise for Suleiman's work has also come from top Israeli military brass. I always believed in the abilities of the Egyptian intelligence service, GIS, Israeli General Amos Gilad told Americans. Palestinian authorities and Egyptian officials during a secret April 2007 meeting whose leaked minutes were recently released by Al Jazeera as part of the Palestine Papers. It keeps order and security among 70 million, 20 million in one city, a reference to the population of Egypt, actually closer to 83 million and to Cairo. This is a great achievement for which you deserve a medal. It is the best asset for the Middle East, Gilad said. The notion that anyone, let alone U.S. officials, could believe that Suleiman would lead an orderly transition to democracy would be laughable if it were not so sinister. Much more likely, the strategy is to try to ride out the protests and wear out and split the opposition, consolidate the regime under Suleiman's ruthless grip with the backing of the Egyptian army, and then to enact cosmetic reforms to keep the Egyptian people politically divided and busy while businesses carry on as usual. Under any Suleiman transition, political activists, journalists, and anyone suspected of being part of the current uprising would be in grave danger. From the American perspective, the strategy can be likened to what happened in the summer of 2008, when the House of Cards international financial system started to collapse. Think of the Tunisian regime of deposed dictator Zine El Abidine Ben Ali as the investment bank Lehman Brothers. When a run on the bank began, the United States government refused to provide it with financial guarantees to bail it out, and it quickly went bankrupt. But when the panic spread and even larger too-big-to-fail financial firms, including massive insurance company AIG, began to see their positions suddenly deteriorate, the United States government stepped in to bail them out with hundreds of billions of dollars. The Egyptian regime is the AIG of the region, and what we are seeing now is an American attempt to bail it out. If Egypt goes under, the United States fears that the contagion would spread, as Arab publics realize that the U.S.-backed despots who rule them can be replaced. The toppling of these regimes, whose only purpose to their people has been security, is not the end of the world, but the start of renewal. Of course, no analogy is exact. Whereas allowing Lehman Brothers to collapse was a calculated risk, the United States did not see the revolution in Tunisia or the uprising in Egypt coming. Our assessment is that the Egyptian government is stable and is looking for ways to respond to the legitimate needs and interests of the Egyptian people, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton infamously declared on 25th January, the day the anti-regime protests broke out. Clinton's cluelessness is reminiscent of her predecessor, Condoleezza Rice's famous words didn't see it coming. In relation to Hamas's victory in the Palestinian Legislative Council elections in 2006. According to the New York Times, Obama himself is unhappy with U.S. intelligence failures in the Arab world. For close watchers of the United States, this obliviousness is no mystery. As Helena Coban has observed, the Israeli lobby, IPAC, and its attack dogs have conducted such a thorough witch hunt over the past quarter century against anyone with real Middle East expertise that the U.S. government now contains no one at the higher or even mid-career levels of policymaking who has any in-depth understanding of the region or of the aspirations of its people. But it is even worse than that. The U.S. policy establishment, compromised by Israel and its pressure, seems only capable of viewing the region through Israeli eyes. This is why, for so many officials and commentators, the concerns of Israel to maintain a brutal hegemony to trump the aspirations of 83 million Egyptians to determine their own future free from the shackles of the regime that has opposed them for so long, and different futures are possible. On the minds of many observers is the Turkish model of constitutional democracy, economic resurgence, and foreign policy independence, all under the rule of a moderate Islamist party. Turkey, once closely in the orbit of the United States, started to break out with its refusal to allow the U.S. to use the country's bases for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. In recent years, Turkey has developed a deliberate 360-degree foreign policy doctrine, which includes maintaining relations with Europe and with the United States, while restoring close ties with all its neighbors, among them Iran and Arab countries, and assuming a greater regional mediating role. Since 2009, Turkey's once close alliance with Israel has deteriorated sharply, even though ties have not been cut. These shifts, along with its ubiquitous consumer and cultural products, have given Turkey enormous regional influence and appeal. Turkey has its own specific history and is no more perfect than any other country, but the bigger point is its subservience to the United States and Israel is not Egypt's only option. The worst-case scenario from the American viewpoint is to have three major regional powers, Iran, Turkey, and Egypt, that are not under Washington's control. Of course, Turkey is carving out its own path, and Egyptians are struggling to go their own way, which may be very difficult. There's no reason either to believe that Egypt would become another Iran, as ceaseless Israeli propaganda suggests. But given a free choice, Egypt is not likely to serve the interests of the United States and Israel the way the Mubarak regime has. So there we have it. The United States is a puppet of Israel, is a colony of Israel, is trying to rule Egypt for its Israeli colonial master. The master race in Israel that pretends that it is superior to all of the races on this planet, as seen in their religious documents and absolutely in their propaganda. So, what are we to do? Well, we're not really in control of Egypt. We try to think that we are, but we aren't. But the Israeli people have allowed us to think that we are, and I suppose that is the orbit in which we are presently parked. Is it an orbit that works? That is close enough to the true realities of this world in which we live that it may sustain itself? We don't know. But eventually, we're going to find out. I will turn now to President Sarkozy of France, who is an arrogant, brutal, and authoritarian demagogue, a perfect Iago. He's been called a lot of unpleasant things, and has had years to prove them wrong, but has not. But what is certain is that Nicolas Sarkozy, who won election as President of France, is one of the most polarizing figures to move into Élysée Palace in the post-war decade. He is a whirling dervish of ideas who inspires hope and fear on both sides of the French political scene. Even many members of his own party, the Union for a Popular Movement, are holding their breath in anticipation of what his presidency might eventually bring. Other politicians don't want to take risks, but he will take any risk. He is also a bit of an outsider, the first son of an immigrant to rise to the French presidency, in a country struggling to integrate second-generation immigrants. The grandson of a Sephardic Jew who converted to Catholicism, in a country in which anti-Semitism was still not uncommon. A graduate of France's creaky state university system, in a country long governed by technocrats, trained in a handful of small, elite, great schools. Sarkozy has always been nakedly ambitious, pragmatic, and calculating, and not beyond betrayal to reach his goals. Sarkozy is full of nervous energy, often rocking on his toes when not at the center of attention, a habit that sometimes makes him look taller in photographs than he is, but otherwise draws attention to his stature. Sarkozy is about the height of Napoleon, and his profile is remarkably similar to that of Louis XIV. Nicolas Paul Stephane Sarkozy de Nagy Bosca was born January 28, 1955, in Paris, the son of a minor Hungarian aristocrat who fled communism in World War II. His mother was a law student, herself the daughter of an immigrant, a doctor who had arrived a generation earlier from Greece. Sarkozy was the middle of three sons, but his father left the family when Sarkozy was four, marrying twice more and fathering two more children. The mother of those children, Christine de Ganay, went on to marry Frank Wisner II, the son of a celebrated spy, and now U.S. Special Envoy to Kosovo. Her son, Sarkozy's half-brother, Oliver Sarkozy, is joint global head of UBS Investment Bank's Financial Institutions Group in New York. So we have a dazzling reality here. The abandonment marked the Sarkozy family, leaving its members largely dependent on Sarkozy's maternal grandfather, with whom the family lived in the 17th arrondissement of Paris. "I was fashioned by the humiliations of childhood," he told Catherine Ney, author of his semi-official biography. Sarkozy's mother finished her law degree, took a job with the mayor of the upscale suburb Neuilly-sur-Seine, and sent her sons on to a private Catholic high school. Sarkozy eventually earned a law degree and became a member of the Neuilly Town Council at the age of 22. But he got his real start in politics as a long-haired, well-bottomed youth leader of the Union of Democrats for the Republic, a Gaullist party led by Jacques Chirac, who was serving his first term as prime minister. Sarkozy's brash manner and strong oratory style caught Chirac's eye and won him the patronage of other party leaders, yet Sarkozy was not afraid to outmaneuver his elders when the opportunity arose. Sarkozy unexpectedly challenged a senior Gaullist, Charles Pasqua, for the job of Neuilly mayor in 1983, becoming the youngest mayor in France at the age of 28. Sarkozy left the national attention in 1993 when he negotiated to free school children, taken hostage by a deranged man who called himself the human bomb. The man was eventually killed by the police and the children were freed. Sarkozy served as budget minister under Prime Minister Edouard Balladur, but betrayed his mentor Chirac by backing Balladur's rival bid for president in 1995. When Chirac won, Sarkozy was shut out of the new administration. He's had a strained relationship with Chirac since then, but his political skills were too powerful to ignore. Chirac brought him back into the government as interior minister in 2002. And Sarkozy has been unstoppable since then, dominating the media and often stealing the spotlight from the president with his projects, including a high-profile law and order campaign. I would like to ask all of you listening to my voice to be sure to post links to AmericanUSSR.com and to JewWatch.com so that people around the internet will be attracted to these sites where they can learn valuable information about how the United States is run and who runs it, and why we are descending into a total depression caused by the Israeli-owned banks of New York. So please be sure that when you blog that you mention AmericanUSSR.com and JewWatch.com, both of which are indispensable to your historical background and for anyone who wants to argue on the internet about politics. If you don't know who controls your nation, then you don't know anything. Stay tuned to AmericanUSSR.com at all times and post it forever so that people around the world will know the dangers that reside inside of the American structure of law and of unruly chaos in which they have infiltrated one nation after another, destroying the destiny of many people and bringing torture and disgust to many persons in this world, including rendition, wherein prisoners were sent to Egypt, which we were just talking about. Prisoners sent to Egypt were under rendition. They could be tortured without anyone knowing about it by the Minister of Intelligence, who is now the Vice President in the surreptitious government of Hosni Mubarak. America, a nation that bears being watched. And what Iran has to do to the world is nothing by comparison to what America, with its 20,000 nuclear bombs and its CIA, has already done to this world. For what America has done to this world is to enslave it, to shut it down, and to make sure that it does what its colonial master in Washington, the freak show of the world, wants it to do. So post a reference to American USSR to every blog where you write a letter or a comment, so that others will have the opportunity to understand what's really happening in this world and how despicable the United States has been during its 225 years of terror, not only over the Indians, but over Spain, England, and every other country with which it has had some sort of commerce. Egypt and what's happening there today is just another of the continuing horror story of American involvement in the world. And it demonstrates how we care little about the lives of students, the lives of peasants, the lives of the poor, because America is a land of the rich, of the elites, of the bankers, of the Jews, those who wish to exploit the world and to carry interest from the wallets of people for everything that they purchase through the usurpation of the money system and loaning of money that is printed by people's own governments, loaning it to them for interest when the Jews themselves get it for free. Yes, spread the word about AmericanUSSR.com so that people can study and know what is really happening in their world. Finally, in our news and comment for the day, a tragic story has happened from Geneva, where Bush has ducked criminal torture charges. Justice for George W.'s torture violations jumped much closer this weekend, because ex-President George W. Bush was supposed to fly to Switzerland to speak in Geneva February the 15th. But his speech was canceled over the weekend because of concerns about protests and efforts by human rights organizations asking Swiss prosecutors to charge Bush with torture and serve him with an arrest warrant. Two things made this possible. Switzerland allows the prosecution of human rights violators from other countries if the violator is on Swiss soil, and George W. admitted he authorized waterboarding detainees in his recent memoir. Torture is internationally banned by the Geneva Convention Against Torture. The European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, the International Federation for Human Rights, and the U.S.-based Center for Constitutional Rights prepared criminal complaints with more than 2,500 pages of supporting material to submit to the Swiss prosecutor. much of it appearing also on AmericanUSSR.com. These criminal complaints were signed by more than 60 human rights organizations worldwide, and by the former UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, the former UN Special Rapporteur also on Independence of Judges and Lawyers, the Nobel Prize recipients Shireen Abadi and Perez Esquivel. Amnesty International, which has repeatedly called for criminal investigation of torture by George W. Bush, sent Swiss prosecutors a detailed legal and factual analysis of President Bush's criminal responsibility for torture. While some traditionalists in the human rights community scoff at the notion that George W. Bush and others will ever be held accountable for their violations, experts disagree. Nobody from those who administered the practices of torture to those at the top of the chain of command is under a shield of absolute immunity for the practices of secret detention, extraordinary redemption, and torture. Martin Scheinen, UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Professor of Public International Law at the European University Institute, told the Guardian newspaper. Legally, this case is quite clear. Bush does not enjoy immunity as a former head of state, and he has command responsibility for the decisions that were taken. Similar efforts to prosecute former President Bush, former Bush lawyers Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, Federal Appeals Court Judge J. Bibby, John Yeo, William J. Haynes II, David Eddington, and Douglas J. Fife are proceeding in Spain. All of these international efforts to seek justice for the human rights violations committed by the Bush administration are possible only because the U.S. has refused to prosecute, another disappointment by the Obama administration. Ironically, February 7th is the 9th anniversary of the date when George W. Bush unilaterally decided that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to enemy combatants. And that, of course, is today. Today, the 9th anniversary of the date when George W. Bush unilaterally decided that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to enemy combatants. George W. Bush denied, as most facing criminal charges do, that the possibility of prosecution was involved at all in the decision to cancel his trip. The human rights community promised to pursue Bush and the other human rights violators whenever they leave the U.S. Catherine Gallagher and Claire Tixier, the lead lawyers authoring the 2,500-page criminal case in Geneva, stated, quote, "The reach of the Convention Against Torture is wide. This case is prepared and will be waiting for him wherever he travels next. Torturers, even if they are former presidents of the United States, must be held accountable and be prosecuted. Impunity for Bush must end," unquote. And so I agree with this. Yes, these torturers must be not only exposed but prosecuted. And they should spend the rest of their lives behind bars for violating the common decencies that mankind expects leaders to hold toward the people within their nations and outside of their nations. These are things that the United States has done which are extremely shameful and which I have archived for you at www.AmericanUSSR.com. For we live in an America that is run by the Jews in New York, who also ran the Soviet Union in Moscow and Petrograd, killing 85 million Christians from 1917 to 1940, using the Red Commissariat and the Red Army, controlled by the Jew Leon Trotsky, who went from New York with $20 million from the Jewish banker Jacob Schiff to start the Jewish state of the Soviet Union, with the sole idea of killing Christians, 65 million of them, and of also assassinating and wiping out the Christian Tsarist family, which had ruled Russia for hundreds of years, blessing that country with good government, with refinements, and with educational systems for medicine, science, theology, history, politics, all sorts of degrees that people could study, including the evolution of law toward human rights. But as soon as the Jews took over, human rights were wiped out. They were gone forever. And the Russian people paid a heavy price for going along with the IPAC of the Soviet Union, just as America is paying a heavy price for kneeling before IPAC here in America, which is IPAC is one of the most dangerous organizations known to humanity, for it is the descendants of Red Bolshevism in the Soviet Union. And what they did there, they will most likely do in the United States of America. They murdered people, carrying them out of their cities and shooting them in the back of the head. Already, the Jews here are lining up in Congress, trying to get hate crimes laws passed to destroy people's civil rights to publish on certain ideas, and especially to mention that Jews are behind all sorts of conspiracies to destroy the First Amendment of civil rights to publish, freedom of speech, freedom of thought, which they are now deeming a hate crime for certain select groups, especially, of course, Jewish people. It's okay for the Jewish people to hate everybody in America by trying to refuse them the right to discuss Jewish people, but for the Jewish people, they have a right to discuss anyone and everyone in all of their newspapers, in all of their movie studios, in all of their news studios, and in all of the television stations and radio stations and companies that they own. For they are everywhere, and they are a threat to our national security.